Back in Bible college, it should probably come as no surprise that I took some theology classes as I was going through my studies. And I may not remember absolutely everything that was said during the lectures, but I do remember this. There was one thing that has stuck with me for about the better part of 13 years. At the very beginning of our Theology 101 class, our theology professor stood up in front of the whole class, and I remember exactly where I was, back corner, trying not to draw attention. And he said this, is the very first thing in the entire course. Everybody, whether they know it or not, everybody does theology. And it affects everything about how they interact with the world. For the past 2 weeks, we've been going through a series that we've simply just been calling Hope, a teaching series that is all about this, finding hope in who God is. Finding hope in who God is. When you think of God, you likely have a picture that comes into your mind or a list of things that you believe about him. And that understanding of who God is will affect the way that you live. Each week in this series, we're going to dial in on one attribute of God, one thing about him, and see what it is that he's revealed about himself to us in Scripture and how we can find hope in who he is. With that being said, we're going to jump right in. If you have a Bible with you today, I would invite you to turn to Isaiah chapter 40. We're going to be going with verses 13 and 14. Again, that's Isaiah chapter 40, verses 13 and 14. There will be a lot of different passages I'm going to be mentioning today, but this is the one that we're going to be sort of hovering around this morning. Isaiah 40, verses 13 and 14. If you don't have a Bible with you, don't worry. We'll have it up on the screen behind me as well. It says this, "Who can fathom the Spirit of the Lord or instruct the Lord as his counselor? Who did the Lord consult to enlighten him? And who taught him the right way? Who was it that taught him knowledge or showed him the path of understanding?" I want you to bear that in mind as we move on. Keep that in the back of your head. I'm going to start here. Language. Language is sometimes a difficult thing to get a handle on, especially when we're dealing with a word that we use to represent a concept that is difficult to grasp in the first place. The first word that I go to anytime I think of something incredibly difficult to sort of grasp is the word eternity. Now, that's a good word. Eternity is a very descriptive word, but we really don't have a mental picture for it. We can try to build a model of it that we can grasp, but still, in a room of 50 people, if you use the word eternity, in a room of 50 people, there very well could be 50 different understandings of how eternity works. My picture for eternity, and just so you know, and I don't understand, this doesn't even really make sense, but when I think of eternity, the only picture that comes to my mind, I think of the color gray for some reason. That's the picture that comes to my mind. I'm not saying it makes sense, but that's just what happens to me when I think of eternity. Or when I think of what's outside of time. Let's go a little bit less abstract, and let's talk about a word that we can see, like house. It's a simple word. My kid comes home from grade two, and he's got a little picture of a box and a roof and all that kind of stuff. It's a simple word. I'm willing to risk this and say that many of you have a unique picture in your head of what defines the word house. And at its base level, the word house describes an enclosure where you can dwell. The enclosure, an enclosed private dwelling. But that definition is open to all sorts of interpretations when it comes to what the ideal house looks like. Do we focus on the kitchen? Do we focus on the living room, the rec room, the yard, how many bathrooms we have in the house? What's ideal? And what you decide about that, or how you answer that question, says a lot about what you value in a home. Then there are even some words that are loaded with all sorts of implications, depending on what your experience has been in them. For instance, and I want to use one that's as uncontroversial as possible. So we're just going to go with the word pizza. Okay. We're just going to go with the word pizza. Pizza, for some people, the implication of the word pizza is birthday parties, get-togethers, easy meal, no dishes. It's something happy. It has all those implications. Whereas for some other people, the word pizza has a different implication. It's cheap. It's unhealthy, unappetizing junk food for some people. It all depends on your experience with it. So we got those three things. Things can either be outside of our ability to contemplate. They can have different ways of sort of defining them. They can be loaded with implications. And the word that we're going to be sort of orbiting around today has all those things. The attribute of God that we're going to be looking at today is the omniscience of God. God's knowledge. And more importantly, how God's knowledge and wisdom can give us hope in all circumstances. So with all that out of the way, I think it's important, because this is such a big word, because, and I don't mean just in the sense that it's like one of those intelligent words or whatever. It's a big word with a lot of different implications, and a lot of different people see it different ways. I think it's important that we all get on the same page of what it is, how it is the Bible defines God's omniscience, because it can be a tricky thing to nail down. Plainly stated, omniscience means all-knowing. On the surface, that's a pretty easy definition. God knows everything, and ultimately, that is where we're going to land. That is true. It gets confusing and divisive, though, when people try to figure out how it is that God knows everything. How is it that God knows everything, and what does that really imply about the world that we live in? It brings up big questions like, does God know the future? Is the future fixed? Does God manipulate the world to fit his knowledge? Does God's omniscience eliminate free will? These are enormous questions that can very easily keep you up at night. I know, because it has for me. And as we look for ways to try and understand God, it's vital that with those questions in mind, it is vital that we continually return to Scripture to see what God has revealed about himself to us in relation to his omniscience. And here's how the Bible describes God's omniscience. First, we'll start with our passages this morning. Again, Isaiah 40:14. Whom did God consult to enlighten him, and who taught him the right way? Who was it that taught him knowledge or showed him the path of understanding? The implication? God's knowledge is self-sufficient, and he needs no help or advice. Where did he get his knowledge from? Him. Psalm 147:4 says this: he determines the number of stars and he calls them out each by name. He knows what's happening across the universe. He's got the big stuff in his view. Matthew 6:8 says this: your father knows what you need before you ask. He knows every detail about you. Not only does he have the entire universe in his view, he's got your heart as well. Romans 1:21 says this: for although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. The implication of this is that, yes, we have a choice. God has given us the ability to choose either him or us. Even with that, Isaiah 46:10 says this: I make known the end from the beginning, from ancient times, what is still to come. I say my purpose will stand, and I will do all that I please. Even though there is free will in the world, he still knows everything beginning to end. In a universe of nearly limitless variables, all sorts of things interacting with one another, God still knows what will happen. In a world on a planet with nearly 8 billion people making decisions, interacting with each other, the consequences of those actions and decisions, all those things, without needing to intercede or predetermine our behavior, God knows what has happened, what is happening, what could have happened, and what will happen. In short, Scripture defines omniscience like this: God's knowledge is infinite and perfect. It's staggering to think about. It is absolutely staggering to think about. Even talking about it up here, it makes my head swim. And I've got it all written down. Like, I don't even have to think while I'm up on the stage right now. It still makes my head spin. It's something that is just beyond our comprehension, and we don't have a picture or anything similar to compare the knowledge of God with. Which is why it makes so much more sense why God would say in Isaiah 55:9, "As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." There is nothing past, present, potential, or future that is outside of God's mind, because God's knowledge is infinite and perfect. God's knowledge is infinite and perfect. That's how Scripture defines God's knowledge. So now that we have a definition, I want to get into why this attribute of God gives us hope, where we can find hope in God's omniscience. And I believe it's this: because God is omniscient, because God knows everything front to back, because God is omniscient, he is not simply the Lord of history. God is the Redeemer of history. We can trust and find hope by trusting that God is the Redeemer of history. I want to unpack that a bit by going back to our passage for this morning, Isaiah 40:13-14. "Who can fathom the Spirit of the Lord, or instruct the Lord as his counselor? Whom did the Lord consult to enlighten him, and who taught him the right way? Who was it that taught him knowledge, or showed him the path of understanding?" Okay, Josh, where are you getting Redeemer of history out of that? We're going to put some context to this. Here's a little bit of background to the text. The prophet Isaiah. Isaiah was a prophet who was active from about the year 700 to about the year 740 to about 700 BC. At that point in history, the kingdoms of Israel, the two kingdoms, the northern and the southern kingdom, were still standing. They were under the control of the Assyrian Empire, but they were still standing. And within the Assyrian Empire, the Israelites still had some measure of autonomy. They still were able to have some measure of freedom within their own kingdom. And that is the context that Isaiah is speaking from, a place of relative stability. It's not going to be until about another 100 years later that the Babylonian Empire comes in and wipes out the Assyrian Empire and takes over that area of the world. And in that time, the people of Israel are going to be exiled from their land. The Babylonians will scatter them to all corners of the known world, and Judah will be emptied of its people. 100 years after Isaiah. And it won't be until about another 100 years after that that another empire will rise and wipe out the Babylonians. The Persian Empire will rise up, wipe out the Babylonians, and under the rule of the Persian Empire, the Israelites will be allowed to return to their homeland, the land of their ancestors. Isaiah is given a message from God for people who are going to be returning to their homes from a forced relocation around 200 years in the future. Not only is that just amazing because God could see that far, but it's also amazing because of this. It's important that they have this message from God from this time, because God knows that the people who are going to be returning to their homes from this forced relocation around 200 years in the future, it's important that they have this message because of the kinds of questions God knows that they're going to be returning with. God knows that these exiles are going to be returning to the land of their ancestors with some really important questions. Think of yourself in a similar situation to the Israelites returning from exile. You've grown up with the stories of your heritage as God's chosen people. And you've heard the stories of Israel's former glory. But you've also been surrounded your whole life by a different culture and a different worldview, a culture that has defeated yours. You've grown up with the gods of your oppressors. And when you're finally allowed to live in the country of your ancestors, what kinds of questions might you be asking at that point? I got a list. I think there's some pretty pointed questions they're going to be asking. Why were we in exile? We're your chosen people. Why were we in exile? Are the gods of our captors greater than our God? Is our God just one among many? If my God is real, why didn't he deliver me sooner? How could God have let this happen to his chosen people? Has our sin separated us from God forever? Any of these questions sounding familiar to you? Just even putting yourself in that situation, would any of these questions sound even remotely familiar to you right now? In a time of crisis or stress or challenge, do you ever find yourself questioning God's control? You don't have to answer that out loud. Or how about this? In a world that tries to explain away God, have you ever found yourself questioning your own faith? Or maybe you've wondered if the sin in your life has driven a wedge between you and God. For the Israelites returning from exile after a long period of crisis and oppression, these were the kinds of questions that would have been front and center for them. Knowing that this would be the case, and knowing what the people will need to hear, God gave Isaiah an advanced message for those people. And that message in verses 13 and 14 is that in all of creation, in the entire universe, in all of creation, only God's knowledge is complete. He knows everything from front to back, top to bottom, beginning to end. And more than anything else, the people needed to understand that nothing has happened in all of Israel's history. Nothing has happened to them that has surprised God. Isaiah was given this vision of Israel's future for the purpose of showing that God is still greater than the idols of other nations, even if it looks like those things, those idols, those other gods, even when it looks like those other nations under those other gods have been victorious. God has still been victorious in those times. He still knew what was going on. The message of Isaiah shows that God is not only the Lord of Israel, he is the ruler over the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Persians. Even if the people are being punished by God for their sins, he is still their Lord. Ultimately, Isaiah's message to Israel demonstrates that God is not the Lord of history because he directs and controls events. No, God is far, far more powerful than that. God's omniscience is so great that he's able to respond to the choices and circumstances that creation puts out in such a way that his original intentions for creation and his original strategy remains unchanged. God does not simply control history. In his knowledge and wisdom, God redeems history. So why is it so often that we find ourselves questioning God in that case? If we can trust that God is the redeemer of history, that no matter what happens out there, that he knows what's going on, why is it that whenever I'm faced with challenge, I so quickly move to question him? For many years growing up, I took swimming lessons. And as I got into the more advanced levels, we started learning first aid techniques, things like rescue breathing, CPR, water rescue, things like that. One of the first things that I have taught us when it comes to rescuing a drowning victim is that the drowning victim is absolutely no help during a rescue. Drowning victim is no help during a rescue. First of all, they're obviously outside of their element if they're in trouble in the water. If they weren't outside their element, they'd be swimming. They're completely outside their element. Because of that, they are panicking, thrashing around, and making it more difficult for someone to perform a safe rescue. If you get too close to a drowning victim, they will attempt to grab you, put their arms around your head, or push you underwater so that they can get up higher so they can breathe. That's their first instinct. They want to treat you like a buoy. They look at you like a life preserver that's going to float. And they will push you right under the water. In order to rescue a victim successfully, it's necessary to stay away from their grasp and wrestle them into a position where they are on their back and able to be towed to safety. There's actually, I was talking to my wife about this last night, and there's actually a scene from a movie called The Guardian where there is a couple who is drowning, and the husband is panicking so much that he's pushing his wife under the water. And as these Coast Guard lifeguards are coming out to rescue them, he is panicking so much that he continues to push his wife under the water just to get his head above water. And one of the lifeguards, in order to get him under control, actually hits him to shock him out of his panic. I wouldn't recommend that if you're trying to rescue somebody, but it happened in a movie. Drowning people think they know what they need in order to be rescued. For them, in their minds, they just need to keep thrashing around and grab onto the person that's coming out to them. But they are completely wrong because they do not understand what the lifeguard understands. They are out of their element. The lifeguard knows what they need to do. Stop moving, get on your back, and let me pull you. If they would just trust the lifeguard, then the rescue would be so much easier for everyone. In much the same way, we don't know what God knows. We don't see circumstances the same way that God sees circumstances. I won't speak for you, but when I feel like I'm drowning, or when I feel like I'm being overwhelmed, or like life is out of control, I know that I can think of all sorts of things that God should be doing to fix my problems. I am full of suggestions. Suggestions and plans. I want my problems solved my way and in my time. And here's what I think that you, God, should do to take care of this situation and just go and bring the entire world back into harmony, bliss, balance, the way that I think it should be. But the truth of Scripture reminds me that this is not my place. In the moments of crisis, God says this to me. Who can fathom the Spirit of the Lord or instruct the Lord as his counselor? Whom did the Lord consult to enlighten him, and who taught him the right way? Who is it that taught him knowledge or showed him the path of understanding? I can't see the whole picture the same way God does. I'm thrashing. He's the one who can swim. Much like the returning Israelites who received Isaiah's words that were written long before their exile, I need to be reminded that my hope in the confusion of life is rooted in the God who is never surprised by anything. There is no one and nothing that can compare to God, because he alone has infinite and perfect knowledge. Only God is omniscient, and because of that, God's purpose for the redemption of his people and creation cannot and will not be opposed by any force in creation. Like those confused and broken people before me, I'm reminded that all that is required of me to live is to live in obedience to God, to live in obedience to the God who sees everything from beginning to end. I believe there is hope and peace to be found if we believe and trust in that truth from Scripture. I'm going to invite the band to come forward to sing "It Is Well" one more time, and as they're making their way forward, I'm going to pray.